It's a great pleasure to be here this week. It's not only because I have the chance to talk about pulsars and what we're going to do with them, but also because we are part of a wonderful conference that's going on right now. And so to the conference participants, I apologize that I repeat a few things that have been said today and Monday and so on, just to bring the other people on the same page. I want to talk about how we can use objects called pulsars to test theories of gravity, in particular pulsars to be found in the center of our galaxy. But before I do this, I have to sort of explain what we've done so far to really put in contrast of what we want to do in the future and where sort of the galactic center can help in comparison to what we know already. So I'll do a little detour at the beginning and show you also the kind of effects that we expect to see also for pulsars in the center of our galaxy. So when you talk about gravity, of course, it is our best understanding. General relativity is our best understanding of gravity so far, and it has been tested very nicely. Not very bright. Let's see. Has been tested very nicely. Much better. Do we have a, anyway? In the solar system, in a rather weak field limit, and of course, it's still general relativity has passed all these tests with flying colors. But it's not the final word. We still wonder whether Einstein was right, or as the Australians say, whether he was wrong. So modern tests of general relativity in the solar system involves lunar laser ranging, so sending laser beams from Earth to the surface of the moon, which is the best evidence, by the way, that the Apollo astronauts really were there. You can do radio reflection at the planets, or you use the signal of spacecrafts and check how it propagates through the solar system space-time, or you can send satellites in the Earth orbit, like the LAGOS and Gravity2-Probe B satellites, that test specific aspects of your theory of gravity. So everything seems to be so fine and wonderful, but the question really is it really our last word in understanding gravity? There's some serious problems, of course. At least I feel very uncomfortable that there's something like inflation that we don't understand. What is dark matter? What is dark energy? And so these are the main key questions why we keep on revisiting the validity of general relativity. But of course, we also haven't seen an event horizon yet. We have black hole candidates, but the last evidence is missing so far. And of course, there are hints that general relativity may indeed not be the last word in understanding gravity, because it's incompatible with quantum gravities, with quantum mechanics. We have singularities, and eventually the general relativity must fail. But whether this is far below the Planck energy so that we can measure it, or whether it's very nearby, we don't know. So what we try to do as observers, we use space to find laboratories where we can test the different aspects of theories of gravity. And as I said, so far, we have really tested it very nicely in the solar system with a quasi-stationary weak field regime. But we also want to test, in particular, apart from the event horizon, the radiative properties of gravitational physics. That's really where the theories are separated from each other, as I will show later in this talk. We can use radio pulsars to test the quasi-stationary strong field regime, where we see radiative properties of theories of gravity. We can go to the highly relativistic regime, hopefully very soon, with the first detection of gravitational waves using ground-based detectors like LIGO, but also hopefully very soon using pulsar timing array experiments, and I have two slides on that as well. My main point here is we need really to test gravity where it's strong and nonlinear. And in particular, as I will show you, we need to test the radiative properties of gravity. And sort of, I will show you then later how that combines with testing the properties of black holes to go to the event horizon. So I'll tell you a little bit about pulsar timing, give you a few examples of what we can do today. I'll then show you sort of what the gold plate standard for theories of gravity testing is right now using pulsars. I say a little bit about alternative theories of gravity. And then at the final part of the talk, I then tell you how we can combine the efforts to image the event horizon in the center of our galaxy with pulsars that orbit also Sagittarius A star. So So as you all know, pulsars are rotating Newton stars. They act like cosmic clocks because they emit a radio beam along the magnetic axis, which is inclined to the rotational axis. And as it rotates, it acts like a cosmic lighthouse. And whenever the beam points towards Earth, you can register the pulse with your radio telescope. It's the most extreme matter in the observable universe. The density in the interior of a Newton star exceeds easily a factor of 10 the nuclear density. And because they're so compact and massive and rotating quite fast, they're really like massive flywheels in space, and that makes them very good clocks. So the pulsar timing experiment is rather simple and clean by its conception. You have a radio pulsar, you have a big radio telescope, and then you measure the pulses as they are received by your telescope. You time tag the arrival times with the local atomic clock, and then you synchronize it with GPS. The way we do this, however, is important to understand that we're actually not measuring Doppler variations of a pulse period, but we actually do a ranging experiment. So let's say that the pulse is typically weaker than your noise, so you have to integrate for a number of pulses until you get enough signal to noise, and then you measure the arrival time, the so-called TOA. You then have a model of how the pulsar rotates and where it is in the sky and so on, and therefore you have a timing model that predicts the future arrival times. You then go back to your telescope and repeat the experiment. Again, you fold, you build up some signal to noise, you measure your time of arrival. In general, the newly measured time will deviate slightly from your timing model, and at that point you adjust it until you fit every future measurements perfectly. And you can see what we do. We actually count the rotation of a Newton star. So between one and another measurement, we can tell you how many rotations the pulsar has done. And by continuing this baseline into the future, we can actually make this more and more precise. And that means that we have at the end what we call a coherent timing solution. It's coherent in rotational phase. And that makes us about a million times more precise than if you would just measure periods or velocities. And so we do this in particular with pulsars that have a binary companion. So our laboratories are mostly those which have a companion where they orbit a common center of mass. At the moment, we know about 2,200, 2,300 radio pulsars, of which 10% are having a binary companion. The shortest orbital period is 94 minutes. And the longest period we know of any radio pulse is 5.3 years. We have companions that are main sequence stars. We have many white dwarf companions, that's by far the majority. We have two handfuls of Newton stars as companions, and we also have a couple of planetary systems. The idea is now very simple. We sit there with our radio telescope. We look at the sky, we see then, we trace then how the pulsar falls around the common center of mass in the curved spacetime of its companion, and we compare this movement in the spacetime with the prediction of your favorite theory of gravity. And we can do this with very high precision. So this is just an example of some of the best measurements that we can make so far. So whenever you see a number in brackets, it's the uncertainty in the digit before. So we know, for instance, the period of this particular pulsar to 2 attoseconds precision, that's the 2 with 18 preceding zeros. But we can also measure distances very precisely, in this particular case, 1 ± 1 parsec. We can measure sub-micro arc second per year precision in proper motion. We can measure the mass of Newton stars, and I'll show you how we do this with exquisite precision. We can also measure the mass of their companions. We can even measure the mass of Jupiter and its moon, because if we wouldn't know the mass precisely, it would shift the center of mass in the solar system, which we take as our reference points for our times of arrival. And if you don't get the mass right, we see a periodic signal in our data with the period of one Jupiter orbit around the sun. We can also do tests of theory of gravity, and I'll come back to that later in this talk. I just want to point out that we also want to detect gravitational waves with pulsar timing, and Xavier has given a talk about that earlier this morning. I just want to sort of convert the limits that we have into a quite impressive number. Essentially, what we have already achieved is a position where we can measure the change in distance between the Earth and the pulsars to about 100 meters over one light year. And that limit is very comparable to all the three experiments that are going on in the world. It's the European pulsar timing ray, Nanograph in North America, and the Parkes pulsar timing ray in Australia. So just, as I said, two slides on that. The idea is quite simple. You have the Earth, you observe a sample, an array of millisecond pulsars across the sky, and if a gravitational wave passes over the solar system and distorts the space-time, it will affect slightly the arrival time of your pulses in a correlated fashion. This correlation depends on the polarization properties of the gravitational wave, and that's the correlation curve you would expect. So pulsars that are in the same direction of the sky have a correlated change in arrival time. Pulses that are orthogonal to each other on the sky are anticorrelated, and then you get a degree of polarization again if they're in opposite directions. So what we try to do is therefore measure the arrival time of all these pulsars and see if we can find this correlation pattern in the sky. And if you have done that, you have detected gravitational waves at nanohertz frequencies for the first time. In Europe, we do this with what we call the European pulsar timing array. It combines the five big dishes in Europe, which are the six biggest dishes at least fully steerable in the world. And together, we actually phase them up to what we call the Large European Array for Pulsars. I would say it's the best and most sensitive pulsar instrument in the world right now. What we do is we coherently add up these dishes to form a 200-meter dish, which is comparable to an illuminated Arecibo, but actually visible to the most of the sky. And so what we do, we then take this big array, take timing measurements, but we can also do images of our sources at the same time if we want to. And this has been operational for quite some time now, and at the moment we take about monthly observations, and with the increase in precision that we get, because timing precision scales roughly with the signal to noise and hence the size of your telescope, we hope to get pushed down to that limit where we finally detect gravitational waves. So that's all very nice that we have all these efforts, either gravitational wave detectors like LIGO, PTA experiments, or in the future, hopefully LISA. But we wouldn't do this if we didn't know that gravitational wave exists. Just one example, because we talked about Lorentz invariance in this conference before. We can use this data set actually also to test the Lorentz invariance in gravitational physics. Let me just show you exactly how that works, just one slide. If you have an isolated pulsar, I mean, now we take one without a binary companion. If you have an isolated pulsar, and there would be a preferred frame in the universe, you can show that the pulsar would actually start to precess around that preferred direction. And that would lead to a change in the pulse profile because it changed the geometry, how the pulsar hits your telescope. And then if you can actually do this experiment, you can compare observations of the same pulsars many years apart, in this case, 18 years. This is a unique data set where we have 20 years of coherently dispersed data. You see there is no change in the pulse profiles, and you can convert this into limits on the so-called parameterized post-Newtonian parameters, in this case alpha 1 and alpha 2. And this limit, for instance, here is 2 orders of magnitude better than what is achievable in the solar system. But that was just an interjection because we talked about this morning. Anyway, so we wouldn't do this pulsar timing array experiments and building gravitational wave detectors if we wouldn't know that gravitational waves exist. And the first evidence for that was indeed provided by the Hals-Taylor pulsar. That's a double Newton star system that was discovered in 1974 by Russell Hals and Joe Taylor using the Arecibo telescope to scan the sky and find pulsars. And it's amazing that the very first binary pulsar they found, and we know about 200, and 80% of them have white dwarf companions. The first one they found is actually a double Newton star system in a very compact eccentric orbit, and that's a beautiful system to test general relativity. What they found is that the orbit is very eccentric. You see this here, the variation of the pulse period as a function of orbital phase. And soon they found out that the orbit is not described by Keplerian parameters, but you have to adjust the orbital description by so-called post-Keplerian parameters. I'll explain you in a minute what that means. And eventually they found that the orbit is decaying. The orbital period decreases, and that's because the system emits gravitational waves. The gravitational waves carry away energy from the system, and if you take energy away from a binary system, it shrinks. And so the pulsars orbit each other faster and faster, but also one pulsar reaches the closest approach earlier and earlier, and that's plotted on this axis here as a function of time. And you all know this plot because it's probably arguably one of the most famous plots in radio astronomy. These data points are listed here, and the solid line is, of course, not a fit to the data, but actually the prediction of general relativity. And so, rightly so, the discoverers were awarded with the Nobel Prize in 1993. Maybe just one comment. In order to actually make that fit to GR, you have to take into account that you have extrinsic acceleration effects between you and the pulsar. And if you wouldn't correct for that, you would get an apparent disagreement with general relativity and the observations. But fortunately, we have a system that is much better by now, where we don't have to apply these corrections yet. And so it's much cleaner and a much better test, but it's also much more relativistic. And that's the so-called double pulsar that we discovered in 2003. Many of people of you have seen this before. This is a unique binary system where we have two active radio pulsars. They orbit each other in just 145 minutes in a slightly eccentric orbit. And that the old pulsar has a faster spin period of 22 milliseconds. It has been recycled by mass transfer in the past from its companion, which is the younger one, which has a period of 2.7 seconds. And they orbit each other, as I said, in 145 minutes. It also is that the orbit is seen edged on. And so we actually get an eclipse which lasts for about 30 seconds every orbital period. Here you can actually see a beautiful plot made by our ex-postdoc, Maura McLaughlin. These are single pulses from the slow pulsar. They have a time separation of this 2.77 seconds. And superimposed, you see the signals from the fast pulsar in the background, where we haven't taken out the Doppler effect, and that's why they're curved in a parabolic form. So it is a true unique double pulsar system. And because it has this very compact tight configuration, it's a beautiful laboratory for general relativity. And it is actually rather close by. It's less than a kiloparsec away compared to the Hals-Taylor pulsar, which is about 8 kiloparsec away. So we don't have that problem that we have this relative acceleration between us and the pulsar. But it's really unique because we have two clocks. We have two clocks orbiting each other. And that allows us to actually measure the ratio of the masses in a theory-independent way. At least theory independent to the first post-Newtonian order. So the heavier pulsar is closer to the center of mass, and so you measure two orbits, and that immediately, the inverse of the orbits gives you the ratio of the masses. And we measure this to this precision right now. Unfortunately, pulsar, the second pulsar B, is not a very good clock at all. We also see the advance of periastron. So like in Mercury, which takes about 3 million years to have an additional rotation in its orbit, where we have a precession rate of 0.0012 degrees per year, we see this in a double pulsar with a precession rate as many orders of magnitude larger, where we measure this effect to 17 degrees per year. So it takes only about 20 years for this rotation of the orbit, which is a manageable timescale. In fact, it has done that now by more than half since we discovered it. By the way, it's also 4 times larger, this effect, than in the Hals-Taylor pulsar. So this, if you believe your theory of gravity, in this case general relativity, you can write down an equation which is, has the, which describes the observed longitude of periastron precession rate as a function of the Keplerian parameters, orbital period and eccentricity, and the two unknown masses of the system. Now, we already have the ratio of the masses. Here we have the sum of the masses, so we have two equations and two unknowns. We can easily solve for this, and this gives you the masses of the 2-Newton star if you believe in GR. Now, GR may not be the right theory of gravity, and indeed you can do this experiment assuming other theories of gravity, but now we know the masses, and you can show that every other so-called post-Keplerian parameter, which is a theory-independent correction to the description of the orbit, is just a function of the two masses and the measured Keplerian parameters. But now we know the two masses. So for every other post-Keplerian parameter, I can now take these values and predict the observed value if your theory of gravity is GR in this case. I can do this for every other theory of gravity, but then the functional form will be different. So for instance, we also measure a combination of gravitational redshift and second order Doppler effect. So what happens is that we have the pulsar clocks, and because the orbit is eccentric, the distance to each other changes as a function of orbital phase. And so if the pulsar clocks are closer to each other, they feel a deeper gravitational field, and this clock goes slower. If they're further apart, the gravitational potential is weaker, and they go a little bit faster. And what you have is a clock variation, in this case, with an amplitude of 383.9 microseconds. Now you can take these two masses I have derived on the previous slide. I can predict what GR would have told me as the correct value, and I can tell you they agree to 0.2% in this particular case. We also see the curvature of space-time in the form of a Shapiro delay. As I said, the orbit is seen nearly edge-on, and that means that the signal of one pulsar passes the Newton star forces of the other pulsar in just 20,000 kilometer distance. That actually allows you to do different two independent tests of GR because the Shapiro delay depends on the inclination angle and the mass of the companion. Both values are sort of unknown a priori. But this is, by the way, the improvement that we have since we published the data last time. You can derive an inclination angle from the shape of this curve, which is indeed very close to 90 degrees edge on, so that's fine. And indeed, the predicted value agrees with the observed value, that is, which is this, to a very good percentage. Also, the mass of the companion is consistent with what we predicted from the two masses that are derived before. What is an interesting experiment that was completely unexpected came actually from the eclipse that we observe. These are two eclipse patterns that we observed shortly after we discovered the pulsar and a few years later. And so the pulsar in the background is on here, then it becomes eclipsed, and it becomes bright again. And there are some spikes in here. And at first, we thought they are random, but in fact, Mora pointed out that these spikes were actually separated systematically. In the beginning, they're spaced by half a period of the slow pulsar, and by later in the precession phase, they're spaced by twice the full period of the slow pulsar. And you can also see that this pattern has changed between December 2003, in this case, November 2007. So what we did, together with René Breton, who was a PhD student at McGill at the time, we took the data, and you can model the eclipse very nicely with just four parameters based on a purely geometrical model where the magnetosphere of the slow pulsar is this donut that blocks the background pulse of a synchrotron absorption, and depending on the orientation of the spin axis, which is slowly rotating in space, due to geodetic precession, the eclipse pattern is changing. And we can reconcile, we can fit all the years of data with just these four parameters. And that allows us to actually measure the precession rate of the spin axis. And that indeed agrees again with the prediction of general relativity very nicely. And this is the first quantitative test of any relativistic spin optic coupling in strong fields. And of course, we also see the emission of gravitational waves. So this animation from Luciano shows nicely what happens in 85 million years because the orbit is shrinking, and that means that the pulses approach each other by 7.152 plus minus 0.008 millimeters per day. That corresponds to a decrease in the orbital period of about 108 nanoseconds per day. And that again leads to then a predicted merger in 85 million years. And it's exactly that kind of merger that LIGO will try to see. And in fact, the discovery of the double pulsar had a significant impact on the expected merger rate and hand detection rate of LIGO. And again, the agreement with the predicted value of GR is very good. The nice thing about all these tests I showed you before, these were five independent tests of general relativity, they all passed. The precision of this test will increase with time by just increasing the baseline of our observations and see how the parameters evolve. I'd like to show this plot. This is the same plot I showed you before. This is the Hals-Taylor pulsar curve. Again, the change in periastron time as a function of year. This is what we predict for the double pulsar. Note that we talk about here from 2004 to 2013, so just 10 years, and so it's kind of this cut in this little diagram up here. The red curve is the prediction of general relativity, and these are our measurements. So this is by far the best confirmation for the existence of gravitational waves, and another justification to spend all this money. At the moment, the test is better than 0.03%, so it's an order of magnitude better than what the Hals-Taylor pulsar has achieved so far and is likely to achieve for the foreseeable future because it's too far away in the galaxy. By how much it's better, that's the work in progress, and if I find out, I will finally publish it. So you could say, great, general relativity has passed this test as well. But as mentioned at the beginning, we have hints from cosmology in particular that we may have deviations from general relativity. And one favorite modification to general relativity is an extra scalar field that we add to the tens of general relativity. And indeed, you find scalar fields, for instance, in superstring theory, in dark energy models, or also, for instance, it has been used to explain dark matter by modifying gravity, for instance, Bekenstein's Terrace theory. So in this case, if you do, so most of the alternative theories of gravity can be recasted in a tensor scalar theory. So in that case, you would have an additional scalar field that couples to the matter. And that leads to effects that are observable. And we do this experiment in a framework of Damour and Esposito-Ferrese as the best modeled, formulated part of the theory, where you get these two extra parameters, alpha naught and beta naught, which describe a linear and quadratic coupling of your scalar field to matter. Now, these parameters alpha naught and beta naught would be zero in general relativity because there is no scalar field, but may have a non-zero value some in alternative theories of gravity. And you can already constrain these alpha naught, beta naught theory parameters in a solar system because they are related to the parameterized post-Newtonian parameters that I mentioned at the beginning. And this is a typical plot how we do this. This is alpha naught on the y-axis, beta naught on the x-axis, and every experiment that you do gives you a line in this diagram. Everything above a line is forbidden. Everything below a line is still allowed. General relativity lies in the origin because both parameters are zero. And the trick is now to do the experiment and see what constraints these experiments give you. So for instance, this is lunar laser ranging. These are real BI measurement of quasars. This is Cassini. This is, again, lunar laser ranging. This is perihelion shift of Mercury. And as you can see, the best test is given by Cassini, but none of the solar system tests actually constrains anything in beta naught. And so that is where pulsar systems become a particular interest. And also, we can use them to actually test strong fields, field effects rather than the weak fields in the solar system. And one of the observables that I was mentioning that a scalar field will produce is a violation of the strong equivalence principle at some point. And that means that if you have a binary system, the two bodies will not fall independently of their composition, but they will actually default depending on what the compactness of the body is. So for instance, that means that if you have a binary companion, you suddenly have a mass dipole, and that means you have dipolar gravitational radiation rather than quadrupolar radiation, which you would have in GR, which is because the graviton has been zero, but with a scalar field of spin zero, spin two, but with a scalar field of spin zero, you would have a significant dipole contribution as well as a potential monopolar contribution. Now, the dipolar contribution depends, of course, on the difference of the compactness of your two systems. If you have two same objects, they will just exactly fall the same, and you don't see anything. And that's actually why the double pulsar, with all its glory, can actually not constrain that well, because the difference in compactness here between the two Newton stars must be rather small, of the order of zero, and therefore the double pulsar is actually not a good system to constrain, in this case, tensor-scalar theories. What you would like to have is actually a system where the compactness is vastly different. And the most wonderful system to have would be a pulsar black hole system, because we don't expect the black hole to have a scalar charge because it has no hair. And so you would maximize the difference between the compactnesses of these two systems. Unfortunately, you would have heard by now, if you would have found one, we haven't been successful in finding a pulsar black hole system. So we're looking for other systems where we can maximize the difference in compactness. And the next best thing for doing this are pulsar white dwarf systems. And in particular, if the white dwarf is massive, you can probe an interesting regime of gravity that wasn't accessible before. And indeed, we have such a system by now. It's a pulsar that was discovered in a Green Bank survey, 0348 plus 0432. It's the first relativistic binary with a massive Newton star. How do we know that the Newton star is massive? Well, we did some observations involving radio telescopes like Effelsberg, but also the VLT. And the VLT is crucial here because the companion, the white dwarf, is nicely visible as a bright source. You can actually get beautiful spectra of the white dwarf atmosphere, and you can actually pinpoint, model all these lines very precisely and get a nice mass measurement for the white dwarf companion. And that error includes the systematics in different white dwarf models. You can also see these lines moving backwards and forwards because of Doppler shifts, and therefore you can easily measure a radial velocity in the optical. You measure this radial velocity in the radio from pulsar timing, you combine them, and then again, you have the mass ratio between the pulsar and the white dwarf. But now you already know what the white dwarf mass is, and therefore you come up with the mass of the pulsar in a theory-independent way. And to our surprise, this is a very heavy Newton star. It's the most massive Newton star we know, and this gives you some very interesting constraints on the equation of stage, which are, however, not much more constraining than what was published by de Morris et al. In 2010, but however, it's measured with a completely independent method, quite different. The de Morris et al. Was Shapiro delay measurement. This one is more or less theory independent, and it gives you a nice constraint and confirmation that heavy Newton stars indeed exist. And this actually rules out a number of equations of states and tells you about the interior of a Newton star or this most extreme matter that we have in the universe. So how does this actually then play out in testing tensor scalar theories? Again, this is the plot I've shown you before. I will now concentrate on this blue box here. This is where our constraints on pulsar timing lies. And this is now in logarithmic scale, so GR is somewhere at infinity down there. And these are the constraints that are set now by this most massive Newton star. It's not yet published, but it sets the best constraint we have. And in fact, as you can see, apart from a small region here in this parameter space, it's much better than any limit that we have derived in the solar system. We have another system that we had where we did the very same experiment before, and it's really comforting that these limits actually agree. And as I said, as with the double pulsar, these limits get better and better with time, and so what we're trying to do is push these limits further down. This goes a certain way, but we would really like to have, as I said, a pulsar black hole system. Oops. Sorry. So if you would find a pulsar black hole system of a stellar mass black hole, it would give you these constraints here. you don't have this peak here because there is no scalar charge in the black hole. And so that would be the best constraints on tensor scalar theories. That is even better than what you can derive in gravitational wave measurements. I point out that earlier this year, there was the announcement by our American colleagues for the first triple system. That's where you have an inner pulse or white dwarf system, and if white dwarf, another white dwarf further out. That's a very interesting system because these two bodies will fall in the gravitational field of this nearby white dwarf. And so rather than seeing the previous system falling in the gravitational field of the Milky Way, they fall much more in the gravitational field of the external white dwarf. And that will eventually give superb limits, again, until we at least find the pulsar stellar black hole. But you, to go down this limit, you do need the sensitivity of the square kilometer array. Just the one word on implications for LIGO and Virgo on our constraint of tensor scalar theory that we have achieved. If you, for instance, take a massive white dwarf, massive Newton star, ordinary Newton star binary system, and then merge and collide and produce gravitational waves, your waveform that is to be measured by LIGO would look like this in GR, but because you have the additional scalar field, you would kind of shrink that in spiral. You would get a difference between a tensor scalar waveform and a GR waveform. And we can point out already from the limit that we have from that system that because we don't see any dipolar radiation, so we can put a limit on a scalar charge, and that tells you already that the difference between the tensor scalar waveform and the GR waveform is less than half a wave cycle, and that allows our colleagues, hopefully, just to use their GR templates and be confident that they don't miss anything. It would be very nice, however, if we find this black hole with a pulsar around it. And so what we really like to have is really doing the same experiments that I described, where we have a pulsar white dwarf or pulsar system, we'd really like to do with a pulsar black hole system. And Vex and Kopeikin were the first one to give a recipe how that experiment would work. And we followed this up with a much more detailed description by a paper by Leo et al. And the idea is quite simple. What we try to do is really see how the orbit evolves under relativistic spin orbit coupling as well as driven by the lens tearing effect. And if you, so what we try to measure is really characterize the orbit. This is the longitude of periastron, this is the semi-major axis, and measure the higher order derivatives if we get a nonlinear variation in these numbers. And if you have these numbers, I'll show you in a second, you can then, for instance, measure the spin of the black hole with a precision of less than 1% if you have a stellar mass black hole and timing sensitivity with the, like, obtainable with the SKA. At least with the spin and the mass that we can measure to better than 0.1%, you can test the cosmic censorship conjecture, hence the existence of an event horizon, and that would be a nice thing to do. But it's hard and nearly impossible with current technology. I wouldn't say that we wouldn't try if you find it today, but really in order to derive the science, you need much more time and precision, and that scales with telescope sensitivity, and that's why we need the SKA. If you had a more massive black hole, it would be much, much easier because the spin and the quadrupole moment scale with a cube and the square of the masses. And that, of course, brings me to pulsars orbiting Sagittarius A star. Here, we don't have a 10 to 30 solar mass black hole. We have a 4 million solar mass black hole. And with that scaling that I just mentioned, these effects are much, much bigger. And so Jim Corder showed some similar numbers in his talk this morning. Let's assume we find a pulsar in a similar orbit as envisioned for the S stars found with the next generation of optical experiments. So let's say we have a pulsar around 100 AU or orbital period of about 3 months or 4 months or so, and the perimeter, the pericenter velocity would be a significant fraction of the speed of light. The pericenter advance would be small in numbers compared, for instance, for the double pulsar where we have 17 degrees per year, but in terms of orbital turns, it's a huge effect. The Shapiro delay even for high inclination angles, would be of the order of minutes. Frame dragging would be of the order of seconds. And bending delay, which is kind of an aberration effect, would also be of the order of milliseconds. So, and then of course we have lens tearing precession, and that is what allows us eventually to measure the spin and the quadrupole moment. So if you measure just one of the parameters that we have measured for the double pulsar, for instance, the gravitational redshift, the Shapiro delay, or the longitude of periastron, you can already do some wonderful things. Let's just concentrate, for instance, on the Shapiro delay, because that's rather independent of the orbital period. Then you can know the mass of Sagittarius A star already to a precision of about one solar mass. Combine that with the precision from, for instance, gravity that Stefan was talking about this morning, that gives you 10 microarc second astrometry. You combine this, because that measurement is independent of the distance, you can actually determine the distance of Sagittarius A star to a precision of one parsec. So that would be nice to have. And of course, you can already compare if the masses that you derive from two different post-Keplerian parameters are identical, and that gives you already the first test of GR, and you can do this more or less in the first year where you observe that system. But we can do more. We can also measure the spin, and most importantly, we can measure the direction of the spin. You can basically, if you look at the equation, you can basically define the orbit in this way, and that gives you a chance to measure the angles of the pulsar orbit relative to the spin. And so this is a simulation that we did for simulated data, where we take this 0.3-year orbit, eccentricity of 0.5, in this case, a spin of the black hole of 0.8. And then you can plot this in this diagram, which gives you the geometry of the spin. And then you basically get the higher order derivatives from this first measurement, and every parameter that you measure gives you a line in this diagram. And this line should intersect at the right spin, and indeed, if you do the simulations, you can recover the spin to about 0.1%. If you measure something like this, where we put in a spin larger than 1, it would still intersect, but you would have then found that the central object is not a black hole, but something strange. Of course, as discussed for the optical stars, there could be a lot of material stars in the central region of the galaxy, which can perturb your orbit. We will face the similar problem. But in this case, we can actually see that we have a problem, because in this case, the lines will not intersect. And the hope is that by actually even able to trace at least parts of the orbit and convert this into measurement, or have additional more pulsar orbits, you can work it out. But if you actually take, for instance, the same kind of stellar population of about 1,000 stars in a milliparsec, and you can compare what the perturbation on your values is, you can derive a plot like this. So this is the mass measurement, so the precession time scale that is caused by either the effect that we're looking at or the perturbations, and we can see the perturbations dominate at least for orbits larger than a year. We would like to have, therefore, orbits smaller than 0.3 months that I mentioned before. And in this case, you can do the experiments. So we really need an orbit of the order of half a year or better. But because this effect is dominant, at least for most of the, at least for up to 10 years, you can certainly easily make a mass measurement and do the first test that I said before. So that gives you the spin. But we also like to measure the quadrupole moment of the black hole. And what happens if the black hole is oblate, because it has a quadrupole moment, the pulsar feels this oblateness every time at periastron. And that changes the orbit every time. And that leads to characteristic residuals that are having an amplitude of a few milliseconds. That is easily measurable with a garden variety pulsar. So you don't have to have a millisecond pulsar to make that measurement. But in fact, as we showed here in the simulations, you can test the Neuhaus theorem by measuring the quadrupole moment to a precision about 1%. That 1% depends, this is the precision here, as a function of orbital period, is actually, so 1% would be here. For most of the orbital configuration, we are optimistic that we can actually do better. So how do we combine this now with the image that we're here for this week? How can we sort of combine that information from pulsars with the imaging of the event horizon? The point here is that, well, it's illustrated mostly in this diagram here. The point here is that with the pulsar measurement, we can determine the spin and hopefully also the direction. And that allows you then to predict what the inclination angle of the image essentially should look like. And you can try from the input of the pulsars to predict what the image should look like. You compare the two, and that gives you another unique test. So in principle, the pulsars test the far field of the black hole space-time, and the image tests the near field, and both have to match. It could, for instance, be that we have deviations from GR which decay rather rapidly. They may only be visible in the near field, but way in the far field, and by characterizing that, gives you a good handle what's actually the difference. So that's really at the heart of our ESC black hole project, and we will sort of give a more detailed description in an upcoming paper. So the question is, are there any pulsars in the galactic center? Well, Jim Cordes gave a nice summary today that we should believe that there should be pulsars. If you look at all the evidence, star formation history, we see supernova remnants. We have indications for star formation history, all very nicely compiled in a paper by Wharton et al. A couple of years ago, which actually predict a large number of pulsars. And you can do these wonderful things I won't have time to go into. You can actually use them to measure the acceleration in space-time and so on. But the problem is we haven't found them yet. If you compare the observed distribution of pulsars as a function of galactic centric radius, you really have this missing population here. And so the question is, where are they? Well, there is one severe selection effect that is caused by the interstellar medium, which is very turbulent, in particular in the center of the galaxy. This turbulence means that you have multipath scattering. So the light of your pulsar is not coming straight to your telescope, but it's scattered at this interhomogeneities in the electron density along your line of sight. And as an observation, that leads to a smearing of the pulse, a convolution of your pulse shape with an exponential decay, because these are the rays that come late and hit your telescope. And this scattering timescale is a strong function of the so-called dispersion measure, which is the electron density between you and the pulsar. And Jim and Joe Lazio have pointed out already some years ago that we expect that scattering timescale to jump rapidly near the galactic center because of the turbulence of the medium that we have there. So, however, as you can see here already this diagram, the scattering is a strong function of radio frequency. It goes down to the fourth power. So the simple answer is, why don't you search at high frequencies? Well, that's not so easy because pulsars are deep spectrum sources. They emit the radiation. I have an intermittent laser pointer. They emit their maximum intensity at a few hundred megahertz, but then at higher frequencies, they have a steep decline with spectral indices of a mean value of minus 1.6, minus 1.7, but we observe pulsars with spectral indices down to minus 3 or more. So the question is then, what do you do? Well, we do have detection of pulsars at very high frequencies. This is some work we have done many years ago where we have detected pulsars at 9 millimeter, at 7 millimeter, and we had one heroic detection at 3 millimeters. So it's a hard work to go to high frequencies because most of the pulses are just too weak, in particular for the size of the millimeter telescopes that we had available in the past. But we had a lucky incident last year that we discovered a pulsar, a so-called magnetar in this case, in the center of the galaxy. The high energy satellites are monitoring the galactic center because they wanted to know what happened to the G2 object. And what happened is that they found a burst and then eventually periodicity in the burst at X-rays. And as soon as the telegram came out, we pointed our telescope in Effelsberg at the source and indeed discovered the same periodicity in the radio and a strong source, that is now known as the magnetar in the galactic center. The estimated distance to the galactic center is 0.1 parsec, and we believe that this is not only projection, but the real distance, because it has the highest dispersion measure of any pulsar in a galaxy. It has by far the highest rotation measure of any object apart from Sagittarius A star in the Milky Way, and that really is consistent with the fact that the pulsar is indeed very close to the center of the galaxy. Now, as I said, this is not an ordinary pulsar. This is a magnetar, and magnetars have high magnetic fields, and most of them don't shine in the radio. We only know 4 magnetars that shine in the radio, and therefore finding such a rare type of Newton star in this tiny spot near the center of the galaxy really points out that there should be other more common ground variety Newton stars and pulsars as well. And indeed, it's a very nice source to observe at very high frequencies. So these are yet unpublished measurements that we took with the Pico Veleta telescope from IRAM in Spain. And as you can see, we have easily detected the magnetar up to 154 gigahertz. And I also firmly believe that this is a detection at 225 gigahertz because it's exactly at the right pulse phase where the emission should be strongest. So really, this pulsar can be seen up to 225 gigahertz. In fact, we have also tried to observe it at APEX, and there is potentially a detection. I wouldn't really do a bet on it, but it's not yet really ruled out. What's nice, we had simultaneous observations with Effelsberg at the same time, and we have measured single pulses of this source up to 154 gigahertz. And now we're in the process of matching these single pulses that we observe at 5 and 8 gigahertz with those at 154 gigahertz. That gives you a wonderful handle, a very sensitive handle on the dispersion measure, for instance, and you can see how that changes with time. Just as a note, we also have broken the record for observing a normal pulsars at high frequencies. Here we have a detection up to, 130-something gigahertz. And this is the new record. The previous one was 87 gigahertz, as I said before. And that really shows you can observe pulsars with a sensitive telescope at really high frequencies. There's also a potential hint that the spectrum is actually changing in terms of flattening. That is not really a surprise because we had already indications of that in the first millimeter observations that we did some years ago, where we see an interesting change in the flux density spectrum at 9 on 7 millimeters. Not for all pulsars, only for a specific set, but that's not so too surprising. You can't see this faint line. It is actually expected, kind of theoretically. This deep radio spectrum, which you can't see, is given by a coherent mechanism that we still don't understand. But there should be always an underlying incoherent emission because we have a bulk of plasma flowing along the feed line and producing curvature radiation. And that would produce an incoherent spectrum like this. And I'm sorry, you can't see this. It would turn over at some wavelength that is comparable to the coherency length of your mechanism. And it's quite possible that we have reached this coherency length at these high frequencies. If that is indeed the case, it makes observation of pulsars at high frequencies even easier in the future. And by the way, there was a similar hint from real observations. And also, if you look at the Crab pulsar, the infrared flux is much higher than the radio flux. So we do believe that it is at some point in the spectrum where it goes up again. So if that's so wonderful, where are they? Why haven't we seen the pulsar? Is scattering the problem that we have not found them so far? Jim Cordos gave another explanation of what could also go wrong this morning. But in my point of view, the scattering is really where the secret lies. And therefore, it's very surprising that when we published our first magnetar data, where we have measured the scattering time for the source, it was expected is rather low, much lower certainly than Cordes and Lazio had predicted in his 97 paper. And so there are lots of papers in the archive describing, well, if scattering is not a problem, where are they? And the interesting, most interesting paper was last week that Newton's stars all collapse through a black hole because they accrete dark matter in the galactic center. So they're very exotic types of theories. But I think, as Jim said also this morning, and completely agree with him, I think the solution is much easier. We have now monitored the scattering time as a function of time, and what you see is something like this. So the scattering time is increasing by a factor of a few, four in this case. And nothing, we don't know whether it's continuing to do so. So the scattering time is really variable. That points to interstellar weather, in particular very close to the source. And by the way, Jeff, for those who were at the conference, the leap observations that we did in my group were around here, so it's quite possible that the scattering was as before. This is when we discovered the magnetar, and so it is certainly increasing with time. Whether it continues, we will see, but what we try to do now is actually decode this and learn more about the scattering screen and where it is. But I think this, the fact that it happened so fast doesn't lead to any other conclusion that there's scattering material very close to the magnetar. It doesn't mean it's the only scattering material. There could be indeed some material further away, but there's certainly material very close. And that's also consistent with the change in rotation measure that we observe. We see a constant rise in the rotation measure. And that can only happen if the radiomagnetic field has a higher weight that's close to the galactic center. So again, it's indicating that the interstellar medium is very turbulent and in fact preventing the discovery of the pulsar so far. So my take is similar to Jim's this morning. I firmly believe that there are many pulsars to be discovered. We haven't been successful for many different reasons, but mostly because of the scattering. So we have to search at high frequencies. And by phasing up ALMA, that is intended to be done for the Event Horizon Telescope, we can take the same data stream, the same beamform data, and search a pulsar. So let's do this, and let's find them, and let's use them. So I think pulsars are a wonderful probe for theories of gravity. They have given us insight. They have provided us with the existence of gravitational waves. The double pulsar provides the best evidence so far. We have seen lots of relativistic effects in action with very high precision. So far, general relativity has passed all its tests with flying colors. But what we haven't measured yet is strong gravitational waves directly. That's where LIGO and hopefully also the pulsar timing array can complement each other because we probe different parts of the frequency spectrum. And we can hope to use pulsars also to probe the properties of black holes. We should be able to measure the spin of the black hole in Sagittarius A star to much better than 1% precision. We should measure the mass of the order of one solar mass, the modulo perturbations. And we should also be able to measure the quadrupole mode. As I said, this probes the far field of the black hole. And it would be ideal to indeed combine this with the near field that we provide, that we get provided by the image and its analysis. And both has to match. Both have to come up with the same answer. And in the best case, as I said, we can use the pulsar measurement, the mass, its direction, and the spin and its direction, and predict what the image should look like. And then you can compare the two. And in my opinion, that's a wonderful test of general relativity and something that we should try and do. Thank you very much.
So, questions?
So, a number of slides ago, you showed exclusion of tensor scalar parameter space
yep.
due to two different pulsars.
Yep.
And the curves moved. And I was just curious why they would change from one pulsar to the other.
Oh, no, they're different orbital configurations. And so the limits that you get is different. And that they move, you're probably more concerned about the move in the top.
Yeah, that's exactly.
That depends on the mass of the companion and the Newton's term, because that the curve comes where you basically can't distinguish the compactness in certain parameter space. Depending on your alpha, you suddenly have a point where the compactness is equal, and then you don't have a constraint. And that's why it's important to get multiple pulsars right. to rule out. And in fact, the double pulsar, I said, it doesn't help much, but it helps very much in this case. In fact, it cuts off. It gets an almost horizontal line, but it's too complicated to explain.
Okay, thank you.
In order for scalar tensor gravity theory to fit the solar system, the coupling constant omega has to be enormous.
Yep.
100,000.
Yep.
Which pretty well excludes it as a standard, for standard principle. However, there are screening mechanisms involved.
Yes, you could have screening.
Visited much at the moment. So, yes, the screening mechanism, a lot of the bad stuff that you compare with Chiaki's rule screened out.
We would like to compare our data with theories that include screening. But unfortunately, none of them is well developed far enough to actually predict what the gravitational wave properties are. And that's what we really need to do our comparison. That's the most sensitive test you can do. If you can't get the radiative properties of your theory right, then that's sort of the gold standard test. And unfortunately, like with most other alternative theories of gravity, the radiative properties have not yet been determined. And so we really need that calculation from the theoreticians to compare that with our observational data. So you find wonderful exotic theories on the web and in the archive. And for us, they're, to be honest, useless because we can't confront them with our experimental data. And if you can't do this, then it's almost pointless. The other theory, for instance, that I didn't show here is where we can do very nice tests is Tevis. Bekenstein's relativistic formulation of Mond. This we can already rule out using the double pulsar. But screening theories, no, we haven't been able to do this because we don't have a handle on what the radiative properties should be.
Next question.
You've been clear. Good.
Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.